This is Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Rob Ferret. An old printer clacks as it produces an image from the first version of Microsoft Paint.
On the fourth floor of UW-Milwaukee's Holton Hall, floppy disks still work, and personal computers from the late 1970s sit side by side with machines built decades later.
This is UW-Milwaukee's Retro Lab, a space where students can learn about the history of computers by using vintage machines themselves.
The lab contains about two dozen fully functional computer systems spanning decades. It's one of only four labs of its type in the U.S.
UW-Milwaukee history major Wyatt Teese helps out at the lab. He spent several hours recently trying to disassemble and reassemble old zip drives from one of the lab's vintage computers.
I think it really brings history to like a tactile present day form. Being able to play like the original Tetris on the Atari, things like that, it's satisfying. It's very, very satisfying. And a lab like this is probably the only easy way to live those moments.
To take us through decades of computing history and to find out what students are learning from these old machines, we turn to Thomas Haag, chair of the UW-Milwaukee History Department. He runs the university's Retro Computing Lab. It's also known as the Retro Lab. Thomas, welcome to the show.
Glad to be here.
Walk us through your lab. What is it like to step it back in time as we enter this curious place?
Well, it's a fairly small room. I think we used to have desks for seven teaching assistants there, essentially in the attic of the department. And over the last 4 or 5 years, as the collection's built up, it's got a little bit more crowded. So at this point, there's about 20 desktop computers from the late 70s to the early 2000s crammed onto those desks and a couple of mobile carts. There's a lot of hardware, software, magazines, peripherals, disk drives, some spare parts and materials piled up on shelves. But the important thing about the lab is that everything we have out is fully functional. So it's possible for students, community members, researchers to come in and have the experience of using a specific piece of hardware or software that's of interest to them and as much as possible, recapture the experience of what it would be like to be somebody in that time period who was using the technology in its original context.
Okay, which machine is your favorite?
Well, you know, I shouldn't have favorites really, but I'd say there's a couple computers there are from my parents' attic or similar to those that I grew up with. So obviously you relate to those. In a personal kind of way. And we find that everyone who comes into the lab has got some kind of memory of technology that resonates with them on an emotional level. Of the computers I didn't grow up with, I think the experience that's been most interesting has been getting to grips with the early 90s Macintosh computers. I'd never been a Mac fanboy, but there's one particular model called Apple IIci, which is just beautifully engineered. You can take the entire thing apart. It's only got one screw in it. And it captures the Mac interface at a point in its development where it had become powerful but hadn't got overly complex.
I can really relate, I think, to those, you know, emotional connections to some of these machines. I mean, I know the day when I sat down in front of the Apple II Plus, and this was probably around 1980, and I was in the basement of my neighborhood, you know, the neighborhood kids, we were all piling around this computer, and the dad had brought it home into the basement and was like showing it to us. And we didn't know what to think, or we didn't even know how to press the keys. It is in my memory. Do you hear stories like this?
Yeah, absolutely. I think everyone who comes into the lab has got something like that. Of course, it's different for each person. But I think it's because we do relate to these technologies in such a personal way, but also they tend to vanish. I mean, probably there hasn't been an enormous amount of change in, say, the kitchen equipment that you use. The houses we live in have not changed very much at all in the last 50 years. Lifestyle, you know, flying in a plane isn't so different now from what it was in the 70s. In most areas of our lives, technology change has actually slowed down a great deal from in the time of our grandparents. But in this area of personal digital media computing technologies, things become obsolete so fast that the things that are so much a part of our lives just vanish quite quickly, and you don't see them for a long time. So it's like being reacquainted with an old friend for many people.
You're a history professor. I'm wondering, why is it important that students learn about this history of computing and be able to touch it and feel it, you know, in this hands-on way?
Yes, I've been researching and publishing on the history of computing for about 25 years now. And for the first 20 of those, I was not engaged with this kind of activity. I was writing books, publishing articles. 5 years ago, I published with my co-author, Paul Ceruzzi from the Smithsonian, a book called A New History of Modern Computing, which tries to, in an accessible and authoritative and comprehensive kind of way, follow through the development of computer technology from the 1940s to about the year 2020. And I was teaching a class around this at the university, and putting myself in the mind of the undergraduates, I realized how hard it would be for them to really take in a lot of this material. So people working on the history of computing have always known that when we're talking about giant mainframes from the 50s and 60s or hand-built university computers from the 40s, we need to convey to people a lot of information about what they look like, what it was like to use them, what they were for, and so on. But we used to be able to assume that, you know, people were pretty much in your position. If you describe an Apple II or a Macintosh or an IBM PC, that they'd have a pretty good idea of what you meant. And of course, with today's students, that just isn't the case.
No, they walk in with a smartphone in their back pocket, and that is so much more powerful than the computers and the machines around them that they're looking at. But that smartphone is all they've known.
Exactly. And I mean, you know, you have that personal relationship with the Apple II,
but I do.
It's a little jarring to realize that at this point, we are further in time away from the introduction of that technology than the Apple II was from ENIAC and the other early programmable electronic computers of the 1940s. Hmm. So it's a very alien experience for today's students. And I realized that if I put together a lab with, you know, initially I had maybe 8 computers as a cross-section of the development from the Apple II through to the early 2000s, that they'd be able to experience that kind of evolution, what it was like to use the computers in a way that they'd never be able to have if they were just reading about them or even watching YouTube videos or using emulator programs in their web browsers.
We're talking about a lab at UW-Milwaukee spanning decades of computer history. Thomas Haag is with us, the chair of the UW-Milwaukee History Department, and he runs the Retro Computing Lab. Thomas, most of the machines in your lab, they come from a mix of sources, hand-me-downs from attics and university surplus and donations and eBay. How are you able to assemble this and source an entire lab's worth of computers ranging through so many decades of history?
Well, it's shifted over time. Early on, the computers were primarily things that I had rescued from my own past in my parents' attic or got from the basements and garages of people in the history department. As the labs become better known now, whenever the IT people find something in a closet when they're clearing out a building, then they bring it over.
Oh, they say, I know also, a guy.
Yeah, they do, and I'm very appreciative of that. And also community members have begun to hear about the lab and donate things. There's typically a need for some kind of repair or maintenance on the machines before they're fully operational. But I think in many cases, people paid an enormous amount of money for these computers. And a couple of years when they were obsolete, I think they couldn't always bring themselves just to throw them out. They put them in the back of a closet or take them up into the attic. And then they just sit there because they maybe don't have the time or energy to actually bring them back out. And perhaps restore them to function, figure out how to get software downloaded from the internet onto floppy disks and that kind of thing. But I think also people feel like they're more than just trash, that they should have some kind of value.
So how do you know how to get these machines back into working order?
Yeah, so it's a mixture. For a historian, I was on the technical side. My first couple degrees were in computer science. And I worked around 1990 for a year before I went to university for a small company that was putting PCs together. Mm-hmm. So I was always pretty confident with MS-DOS and 386 motherboards and those kinds of things. And I found I had those skills still at the back of my mind. It's kind of like knowing how to change and swaddle a baby. It's something that you really spend a lot of time on for a while, and then it becomes this kind of useless knowledge, and you don't know if you're ever going to need it again. In the other areas, there is a community of retro computing enthusiasts that is actually much larger than the academic community of people interested in the history of computing. And they have a lot of online resources, programs, YouTube channels, some of them with hundreds of thousands of subscribers. There's an event in the Chicago area every year, the Vintage Computer Festival Midwest, with many thousands of attendees. So I don't always have to go back and try and figure this stuff out for myself. It's often easy to find the resources online.
So there's a social connection here. There's a community of people who share this interest as well.
There is. And it's something that's tended to be distinct from the academic historian community, where, you know, we're more about books and articles and going to archives and working with primary sources. The crossover occurs more in the museum community because, of course, museums are about collecting and displaying and interpreting artifacts. But the major museums that have been active in this area, like the Smithsonian and the Computer History Museum in California, have been primarily about putting computers out in glass cases, but not usually even knowing if they would work or not if they were plugged in.
What modern machines do you have your eye on, or do you think will be significant enough to join these machines in this lab in the coming decades?
Yeah, it's an interesting question. I think PCs and Macintoshes have both become rather generic and interchangeable. And I think our experience of using them is different. I mean, if you were using a PC back in the early 90s, it was very much a part of the experience that you had to know how many megabytes and what kind of processor and how many megahertz, mostly because everything was always too slow to run Windows properly. And so you had that awareness of what it was that you had and why it wasn't as good as the new gear. And in recent times, I think unless you're a video gamer who still is very into knowing exactly what graphics card you've got and tweaking things to get the maximum possible performance, for most of us, we don't have that kind of relationship with our desktop PCs anymore. So certainly the early models of the iPhones, I think, are something that people went back to having that kind of very personal relationship with. One of the issues for all this kind of preservation work is that the systems that we use now are not self-contained. So if you have something like a video game console from the 80s or 90s, it may need some repairs to the hardware, but if you've got a console or a CD and the thing, you can still plug it into a TV, play the games, have the experience. Pretty much everything we use now is subscription-based and has a cloud component.
Yeah.
So there's a real issue there that the people in the software and video game preservation community are coming up against, that having a piece of the game as it was downloaded onto a games console or a computer doesn't mean you can actually play it anymore if they've taken down the servers at the other end.
I understand, of course, you host these public lab hours. Community members can use some of these vintage computers. How has your lab been received by visitors outside the university?
It's really been fun for me because I have put quite a bit of time into it together with other volunteers. So having people come in, use the machines, have those experiences is a fun kind of thing. So I always enjoy hosting visitors in the lab and hearing the stories that they have about what the technology meant to them.
What is next for UW-Milwaukee's Retro Lab? Where do you see it headed?
Well, I hope that it's going to be able to continue for a while. And there are some specific systems that we'd like to add to the collection, but you know, we can't aim to be comprehensive. So I hope that more people are going to get involved in using the lab for research purposes. We have some students in the history and English departments at the graduate level, for example, who are starting to use the things for their thesis projects. And I think it's a chance for people from different kinds of backgrounds. You know, I mean, the students love talking to the people who come in from the broader community and share their experiences. So although the focus is on the technology, I think it's really the human connections and experiences around it that make it so rewarding.
Thomas, thank you for joining us.
Oh, thank you. It was a pleasure talking to you.
Thomas Haig is chair of the UW-Milwaukee History Department and manages the school's Retro Lab, which showcases working computer systems from decades ago.